This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, and our new frequency, 104.3, Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, your host Linda Olsen-Osterlin interviews journalist Victoria Bertain about justice denied at Guantanamo. She's the author of the recent article, Guilty Until Proven Innocent, How to Pre-Convict an American.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Political Perspectives on KBOO. I'm Linda Olsen-Osterlin, your host for the next half hour. Our topic is the treatment of American Muslims by the U.S. justice system. My guest is British journalist and author Victoria Bertain. A former editor for The Guardian, she has authored or co-authored two plays and four books. Her most recent book is Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. Today, however, we'll be talking about a recent post of hers, a June 9th post on Tom Dispatch titled Guilty Until Proven Innocent, How to Pre-Convict an American Muslim. Thanks for joining us, Victoria Bertain.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm very glad to have you again. And I've read your dispatches over the years, different articles of yours on different sources, and it's always good to talk to you. If you would, tell our audience a little about your history as a journalist with this, quote, war on terrorism, and how it led you to writing the post that I'm talking about on the treatment of Muslim defendants accused in terrorism-related cases here in the U.S.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Well, I was a co-author of a play about Guantanamo back in 2004, and my job was to interview families of men from Britain, some British, some not British, who had ended up in Guantanamo. And if you can remember back to then, at that time, nobody really knew who those people were. And so it was very difficult doing those interviews, because what I found immediately was the families themselves didn't know why their sons or their husbands, who'd gone to all sorts of different places, including in Africa and in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, usually as aid workers, although in some cases as businessmen or as Arabic students, how they had suddenly ended up in Guantanamo Bay. And there was like a blank of information. And over the years of knowing the women from those particular families and then others, I began to find a kind of network of what had happened to Muslim families, particularly Arabic-speaking families in Britain. And as a result of that work, I became interested in cases of a number of people from Britain who were going to be extradited to the United States last autumn. Two of them were British, and the two that I got to know were respectively Egyptian and Saudi. And when I say I got to know, some of them I spoke to on the phone from prison, because they were held in prison in Britain while awaiting extradition and while combating that extradition. One of them was held for 14 years.
Oh, my goodness.
For 6 years or 8 years.
All awaiting to be sent here?
Yes. And and during that period, they went through all the British courts appealing against the extradition order. They even went through the European Court of Human Rights. And one of the planks of their defense as to why they shouldn't be sent was always that Muslims were held in prison in America in extremely harsh conditions, and also that Muslims in America did not get fair trials. This was the contention of their lawyers. So I decided to study some of the iconic American Muslim cases without knowing anything about them. And for my latest book, I began to interview the daughters, in fact, of those iconic American families. Now, your listeners may know some of these cases. There's the case of the Florida professor, Samuel Arian, who's currently under house arrest. There's the case of the Holy Land Foundation leadership. The Holy Land Foundation was the biggest, most successful Muslim charity in America. And under the Bush administration, it got closed down, and its leaders were accused by the Bush administration of giving what was called material support to terrorism.
Talk a little bit about this statute, the material support statute, because it's prominent in how they in the cases that they're going after in this. And it's also such a stretch for many of us. So can you talk about that statute and how that's being used in
yes,
all these cases?
Now, material support means any kind of assistance to any group that has been defined as a terrorist group by the United States government. And to take the case of Holy Land, which is the best known, I think, of these cases, the Holy Land Foundation gave financial assistance to committees in Gaza which supported orphans and women's empowerment. And those same committees were also supported by the European Union and also by USAID.
So they were sanctioned by those two governments, our two governments.
Yes.
I mean, they were basically, you know, we don't give money to them if we don't say that they're okay.
Well, the thing is that that normally in the world you can give charity to anybody who appears to need it. And in Gaza over the last 10 years, where there's been so much need, it was a kind of obvious place to be giving aid. And as I say, that aid was similarly given by the European Union and by the United States government. But because Gaza was being run by Hamas, the elected government, but Hamas at the same time as being the elected government in Gaza is on this list of terrorist organizations drawn up by the U.S. State Department, they were able to go after the Holy Land Foundation to say that giving any support to these charities was effectively supporting the government of Hamas, i.e. a terrorist organization. It was completely illogical because, as I said, there was aid going from the European Union and from American government sources. But they chose to go after these particular people. And there were two long, long cases about Holy Land. And in the first one, there was a mistrial. And then the second one, obviously, there was a new jury and new evidence was brought and new witnesses were brought. And many of those witnesses, which actually included an Israeli government lawyer, they gave evidence that Hamas, they showed the jury lots of video of suicide bombing. And the jury was supposed to make the link between giving aid for food and school books and shoes for orphans to suicide bombing inside Israel. And as I said, in the first trial, it didn't work. In the second trial, the jury did find them guilty of supporting Hamas. Now, what then happened was that the leaders of the this big charity were given 65-year sentences. 65 years. And their lawyers were completely, utterly gobsmacked by this. They simply couldn't believe it.
We love that British phrase, gobsmacked, meaning completely stunned.
Yeah, beyond astonished.
Yes.
And
what treatment were... Well, there's a couple things here. Obviously, I mean, you talk in your... excuse me, you talk in your article about silencing the Palestinian cause in America. And if you make it illegal to aid in Gaza, that is one more death knell to Gaza. It's maintaining a prison there. That's really an open camp prison. And so I think people can really see that this is being used as a political tool. But can you go into the treatment of people like them while they're in pre-trial, before they even get to the trial stage?
Yeah, this is a very, very important point. And I want to use the case of the Florida professor, Sami Al-Aryan, who was held in pretrial detention in solitary for 3 years. And the accusation against him was he had given material support to another Palestinian group called Islamic Jihad, which is also on the terrorist list for the Americans. But there's no evidence, and no evidence was brought, that he was a member of Islamic Jihad. It was just said. And in that three years of solitary, Professor Al-Aryan was held in really, really deplorable conditions.
What prison was this that he was at?
He was held in about 14 different prisons in Florida. In one of them in particular, he was, which I think was called Coleman. Sorry. He was held in a completely windowless cell and not allowed to have any kind of access to anybody. He was on 23-hour lockdown in this place, Coleman. He had strip searches whenever he was going to meet his lawyers. And when he had a visit, also he had strip searches to visit any of his family. But he only saw the families between plexiglass.
So the strip searches are an interesting technique. They seem to be clearly punitive. If he's been in the prison, he isn't going to be in direct contact with anyone outside it. That seems like just a punitive measure, one that they're also using at Guantanamo when they want to phone, when the prisoners right now want to phone their attorneys. Reports are coming out that they're being forced to undergo violent strip searches, including, touching their genitals, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, there are, unfortunately, many parallels with Guantanamo, and I think it's kind of a shock to some American people to know that these kind of attitudes to prisoners, and let's just remember that of the 160 men still in Guantanamo, 86 of them have been cleared already, so we have to assume they are also innocent. So all these years have gone by, and men are held in these conditions, and to remain with the ones in the United States, visits, family visits, and legal visits were extremely difficult. The man was shackled, and there's a...
Is this Sami Al-Aryan you're talking about again?
Al-Aryan, there's a terrible drawing that somebody did of the way that when he went to meet his lawyers, his hands were shackled behind his back, and he had to carry all his papers for the lawyers on his back. And you see this drawing of him bent over with his hands shackled behind him, and he's walking with these papers balanced on his back. And that's because the warders in this prison would not help him in any way. They thought that this kind of treatment was normal. And I think that when Americans know about this kind of treatment for people who have never actually been convicted of anything, it's completely and utterly shocking.
Well, certainly we would find it shocking if it was in any other circumstance, but I think that to some degree the propaganda has gotten over that these must be in some way dangerous to America or they wouldn't have been picked up. Though I think many Americans are getting very clear-headed about what looks like entrapment in many of the cases that they bring in the United States and looks like cases that wouldn't have happened at all if the federal government hadn't provided the actual material support to carry them out. This is Linda Olson-Osterlund for Political Perspectives, and I'm having the honor of talking to Victoria Brittain. She is a journalist in the United Kingdom. She's a former editor with The Guardian. Her latest book is called Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. She was also the co-author of a book called Enemy Combatant with Mozambique, a former British prisoner at Guantanamo who is now out and wrote that book with her. So I'm very happy to have you joining us here on KBOO. Can you talk about something called SAMS?
Yes, no, I'm very happy to bring up the question of SAMS, because SAMS, if we hadn't had George Orwell, we wouldn't understand SAMS. SAMS are an order that was actually invented for convicted criminals who were gang leaders. And because these were very dangerous men, their ability to interact with anybody outside the prison was severely restricted by what were called special administrative measures, SAMs. Now, that was before 9/11 and before the Bush administration. But after 9/11, in the Patriot Act, SAMs were tightened up and began to be used not only for after conviction, but also for pre-trial on a number of Muslim prisoners. And the effect of these SAMs is that neither the lawyer for the individual in the prison nor his family can speak about anything to do with his conditions. So I've written in this latest piece about a young man, a young American Palestinian called Ahmed Abu Ali, who's on SAMs. Now, because he's on SAMs, his sister or his lawyer cannot tell me or any other journalist or any other person whether he's in good health, what is his mood, anything at all about him. And this means that people, once they're on SAMs, either before trial or after, are completely cut off from anybody knowing about them. And I made the parallel in the article between Ahmed Abu Ali and Bradley Manning. Now, because Bradley Manning was not on SAMs, and he had a very loyal friend and a very excellent lawyer visiting him, we all got to know that he was held nude at night and that his glasses were taken away from him and that he was held in solitary. And all the things that happened to Bradley Manning, we knew about. But for men who are on SAMs, such as Ahmed and many other Muslim prisoners, we can't know anything about them, which means that these cases can just so easily get forgotten.
Well, yeah, it's the complete isolation. It's a modern version of disappearing. You know, in Latin America during the Reagan administration, there was a constant misuse of our southern brothers and sisters, and including militias that would do things like that and basically disappeared. They were called the disappeared, and I think probably that's almost a little too crude for the United States at this stage because of media and stuff. But this is a very effective way of disappearing people and disappearing the treatment of them. I think it's important, particularly important, and that's why you brought it out so clearly in the article, that many of these people are pre-conviction. Yes. There's no proof that they have done anything related to terrorism at all. And I have never heard of people being held in such incredible conditions unless they're, you know, like need to be in a psychiatric ward because they're, you know, having a schizophrenic breakdown. These are really unusual circumstances for before a conviction.
Well, unfortunately, they're not so completely unusual because they're happening to a lot of men.
Yes, I meant unusual in our normal system of justice. We don't think of solitary confinement for someone who's not committed any kind of violent act we know of, for example.
Absolutely. Well, there's a particularly good case of a prisoner called another American called Syed Hashmi, who was held at the Metropolitan Correction Center in New York City, which many lawyers who've worked with prisoners who are held there before trial talk about the really, really horrendous conditions of deprivation. And when Hashmi was put on SAMS, he spent 3 years before, like Samuel Aryan, 3 years before he came to trial. And for the last several months of it, he never saw anybody except his lawyer. He was not allowed family visits or phone calls. He had almost no contact with the outside world through newspapers or anything like that. And when he came to court, he pleaded guilty on one case. One of the
different charges that they brought
against him. And it's, I think these SAMs are very, very intimidating to people. And that is kind of part of their point.
Well, yes, if you thought you were going to spend your whole life this way unless you just got it over with and, you know, took a minor charge or more minor charge just to get better conditions, you certainly would. Anyone would.
But the other part of that, which links back to what you said about entrapment, is that there's quite a history of men turning to become government witnesses in order not to have to go through these kind of conditions. And those witnesses are often not the most credible people, and it's like a deal. If you will inform on Mr. X, instead of getting 30 years, you'll get time served and you can come out. And the sort of deep corruption within this system, I think, just has not really been well understood by so many people.
I think they use the fear of, you know, an attack, of some sort of an attack over and over again to convince the American public that these people are dangerous. And for those they don't convince they're dangerous, they're at least marginalized enough that people aren't going to take action. You know, it takes a lot to get people into action, and I don't see a lot of action to support those who are, Muslim men who are being brought into these kinds of situations. Can you talk a little bit more about the SAMs and the effect that they have on family who are trying to stay in touch with or support their family members?
Well, of course, it's completely devastating for a mother or any family member to have your only contact a weekly phone call of 15 minutes in which you can't say anything, and the prisoner is never going to complain about anything because he's always afraid of having, that's the tiny lifeline to the family, is to have that link. And often men, for very minor infractions, get their phone call taken away or the right to write letters taken away. And I think the isolation of the men, of course, there have been many, many studies done by psychiatrists about how solitary does drive people completely mad. Many, many studies on that. But at the same time, when you see the families and you imagine what it's like for the families having such a tiny, tiny contact with a prisoner, it's just devastating for them. And I've seen many, many brave families who do carry on because there are other children involved and the whole family tries to stay together. But it's often very devastating. And people have had complete breakdowns, not just the prisoners, others, because I think the unrecognized injustice is really difficult for people to in any way accept. And we have some experience of these kind of things in Britain. We had a whole series of very famous miscarriages of justice that lasted 15, 20 years against Irish people. And we all know that when those were finally overturned and the men came out, they were not the men that went in. And neither were the families, the people that they were before this trauma completely overwhelmed them. So I think it's really difficult to put oneself into the mindset of a mother or a wife who's having to live through this. And my admiration for the women that I've met in America who are supporting their families through these things is just enormous. I mean, they are amazing people, but it takes a huge, huge toll.
I can only imagine, and on the children as well, knowing that their puppy is locked up like that. You know, you said in the article that there were 246 unindicted co-conspirators in the Holy Land case, and that's another way of spreading the terror. That leaves all of those people, like, you know, people here in Portland, there's a secret grand jury that's been going after anarchist youth, and it can create a chilling effect or create a kind of an intentional kind of terror among the larger group, just by these, especially with laws like material support, are so vague, and many people are being arrested for giving to what they clearly thought was a charity and even was a designated charity by the State Department at the time that they gave money. So this has a broader chilling effect on everybody and sets up a greater sense of fear, I would think.
I think there's absolutely no doubt about it. I was in the U.S. a couple of months ago doing a tour with my book. And I was really taken aback by how, when I spoke in a mosque, or sometimes I was invited to private Muslim gatherings in somebody's house, and the level of fear that people had about in any way speaking out was something that, coming from Britain, I just had never seen anything like it.
I believe we're seeing that here in our Muslim community in Portland. There was the case of a young teenager who the FBI worked with for 2 years and then did a setup entrapment of a supposed bombing at a tree lighting ceremony. Many people feel it would never have come to anywhere near that if the FBI hadn't engineered it themselves. But following that, there's another case where they have arrested a man named Riaz Ghatir Khan, forgive me for pronouncing his name, to his family out there. And that case has received some publicity, but it's very, very quiet. And I think that it's once again a material support case. It looks to me like the government has a very tenuous basis for contending support for terrorism. And yet this case is definitely moving forward. So I think, you know, here in the Portland community, we see that as well. And all of us progressives should make a point of looking out there. And when we see our Muslim brothers and sisters, just, you know, give an extra smile and nod so that they know that they're included in our community here and not isolated from it.
Well, I think there have been some really remarkable acts of solidarity and kind of campaigns of solidarity by non-Muslims for Muslims. I'm thinking particularly of people in Albany, upstate New York, who had exactly the kind of case you're talking about there, in which a young imam who was a fairly recent immigrant had exactly this kind of entrapment case and has been put away for far too many years. But he has got huge support in the community, and people visit him and people write about him. And I think any of us that make any small radio program or a small article that mention any of these cases and that bring up what you've been talking about entrapment and so on, it's an important act of solidarity with the people it's happened to, but it's also a very important kind of educational outreach towards people who may not have looked at these cases, but now then may be interested to go and study them.
Yes, I agree with you, and thank you so much. Victoria Brittain, we're out of time. I've been speaking with Victoria Brittain, a British journalist and author. Her newest book, Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. I hope I can have you on again, Victoria, about that book. So we'll talk about that offline, but I would love to bring your book to our audience. So that in the future. And thanks so much for joining us here on Political Perspectives.
Thank you for inviting me and for your very, very sensitive questioning. And I wish you very good luck with your audiences.
Yes, thank you very much. And once again, this is Linda Olson-Osterlin for Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock, and I'd like to say thank you to Kurt Lauer, our wonderful engineer today.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9:29. Coming up next at 9:30, we'll hear an excerpt from the series Radio EcoShock on solutions for collapse with Sri Lankan-American author Ashoka Bandaraji. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, war resistor Diane Wilson talks about her water-only fast in support of the immediate closing down of Guantanamo Prison. And at 11, it's The Food Show with your hosts, Kate Welch and Christopher, and I'm sorry, I can't remember Christopher's last name. I apologize.
KBOO Board Elections 2013. KBOO members, do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you excited about the possibilities for KBOO's future?
Are you an active member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors.
Applications are now being accepted until June 28th, with candidate training on June 30th. To apply, go to kboo.fm/board elections or email kbooelections@gmail.com.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Could you leave civilization and survive? Really? Are we permanently plugged in? I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to a mixed bag of green